geography. Society. The podcast. Hi, this is Petra, Emilia,
Rafael,
Sophie,
and Patricia.
And we are an international group of MA students on the Photography and Society course at the Royal Academy of Arts in The Hague.
And this is Photography and Society, the podcast,
created in response to the Undisciplining Photography Symposium.
Welcome along and thanks for listening.
Dear listener, this is Emilia, Emmy, your host of today's episode. I hope you have enjoyed your summer break. Mine certainly wasn't long enough, but I'm very happy to be back with you. I'm very excited about our new guest, Alexa Vachon, a wonderful photographer, a recent graduate of Master of Photography and Society program at the Royal Academy of the Art in The Hague, an activist, an educator, a thinker, and a great human being I'm proud to call a friend. Alexa is Canadian-born, New York-educated photographer whose work focuses on themes including women's rights, queer identity, human rights, cultural integration, family structures, and the responsibilities of the artists and makers today. I've spoken with Alexa not once, but twice, and you're going to hear both conversations in this podcast. I feel like I learned so much from talking to Alexa, and I hope you're going to enjoy listening to this podcast as much as I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for listening, and welcome.
Photography on the Run.
In Photography on the Run, we ask people to describe one photograph related to this episode. For today's episode, together with Alexa, we chose one of her images from her newest series, Skin Berlin. You can check the image on our Instagram, Photography in Society. Have fun!
Photography on the Run.
So I can see two people, probably two guys, touching each other and hugging. The position is like big pretzel.
The one person is holding the other person with two hands. The other person I don't see so good.
The composition is a bit intricate. I'm very attracted by the image because I want to really understand what's going on. But at the same time, I can't really define in my head the shapes that I see.
You know, this is human, but also it's not. It's like this creature.
It takes a minute to see where one stops and the other ends. There's this gorgeous light and shadow.
I thought it was an ass, and then I realized it was a neck. I thought it was more like an erotic picture, but actually it's a picture of love and feelings. Feeling the body of someone else close to yours in silence without talking.
There's something sad about it for me. Like someone is crying and bowing at the same time. Depends on the angle.
There's a stillness to it. It's quite amazing, their gesture, the posture. It's the kind of intimacy you would expect if you're laying down in a bed, but they're standing or moving in space, so I really wonder where they are.
I want to play with this image because it's been cut in the middle.
The upper body is of an old human being, and the one on the bottom is carrying that being, but also not really carrying it, kind of floating in space.
But it also looks mysterious. If I actually move it, then things are happening now. Then it becomes something else. Oh yeah, like this. Okay, here we go. That's more interesting already.
Because you can't see either of their faces, it welcomes me to imagine who they are or to become part of that moment.
There's a lot of meaning behind it.
This is my last vape.
That's a good start.
I'm really excited to do this.
Yeah, I'm really excited as well. You have just graduated from the master's program, and I'm really curious, what's life like right now? What's going on?
I literally graduated yesterday, so life hasn't changed much. I can't tell you about life before MAPS or life after MAPS, but I will say it was an intense time. I feel very glad and lucky and fortunate to be done. and feeling like my time there was productive and was effective and that I got something out of it. And now I'm in the process of trying to move to two different countries and start an entirely new chapter in my life.
That's crazy. So you're moving to Toronto, right? That's where you're originally from?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Toronto in Canada, but I left 23 years ago. I lived in New York for 11 years where I did my BFA in photography and I worked as a photo assistant. So my background in photography is really from the commercial world. I always saw myself in that world working as a photo assistant. That was the world I was in. I learned so much about, you know, light but mostly about interacting with people when you photograph them and all the other things that go into being a photographer. And then I moved to Berlin, where I lived for 11 years and where I really kind of came into my own and found my own practice and lived a very different life than I did in New York before deciding to do a master's in the Netherlands with you at the Royal Academy of Art. And now, after 23 years, I'm going back to Toronto to begin a PhD.
I'm curious, that's quite a cheesy question, but so where did photography start for you?
It started really early. I was in seventh grade and we had a week of, I think it was called special art or special something. I went to one of these wacky alternative schools for children of hippies. And so we had a week where we could do basically different workshops. And one of them was photography. And I was just like, I have to do the photography workshop. And the first day was, you know, go out and shoot a roll of film. And my dad, the lovely man that he is, was like, well, why don't we develop that roll of film ourselves? So the very first roll of film I shot, I then developed in my basement with my father and I haven't looked back since. And it was with his camera, which I still have, which I don't use often, but I will have forever and ever, which is an old Nikon F3, 35 millimeter. So that was in seventh grade. And then I started kind of seriously getting into photography when I was about 15 or so. And at that time, I was also a dancer. And I started really by photographing my friends who were dancers. So I would photograph them on stage and off stage. And it's interesting because the project I just did is probably the project that most consciously refers back to the body in that form.
What kind of dancing was it?
I was a professional modern dancer, and that really did inform a lot about my approach to photography, although I would say I wasn't aware of that until recently.
I actually was also a dancer, and it was my first big love, a huge passion.
You know, it's interesting to bring this up now because this project that I just completed, like days ago, is so much about that. And what I see now is I've done a lot of work about the body and I've done a lot of work about portraits. And I've also done a lot of work about women's football, soccer, particularly women's amateur soccer around the world. I always knew that my background as a dancer was so critical to being able to do that work. For me, the things that I take away from it are the anticipation, the intuition, the moving with someone, knowing where they're going, knowing what bodies can do and what bodies can't do. And in this latest project, which actually all took place in one room, it really became a dance, a two-way dance, where I was constantly moving with the camera as people were moving in front of the camera. And I think the dance background, I think, again, things you're not necessarily aware of when you're doing it, but I became aware of what it is to perform, what it is to have a stage, what it is to be seen, and also the limitations and possibilities of a body, but really intuition and anticipation.
I haven't thought about this dancing, to be honest. I really put it behind, but that's really interesting to go back to it. So about this project, it was a master's project, and I know very little about it. I just know that it was all shot in one room in Berlin. How did it come about?
So this latest project, which is called Skin Berlin, 52.49 degrees north, 13.42 degrees east, is a project that I did in one room in Berlin. And the reason for that was I was also, stricken down about a year ago with unknown form of vertigo, or the form is known, the diagnosis and the prognosis is unknown. And it changed my life dramatically. I went from someone who really traveled the world and was very comfortable alone in very many different spaces to not being able to leave my house on my own. My condition has improved drastically and will continue to improve. And I'm very hopeful that things will change. But this happened 2 months into the first COVID lockdown. So while my body was stuck in a room, the whole world was kind of stuck in a room. And I decided that instead of fighting that and instead of trying to be the photographer I was before, who really was, you know, someone who would go out and engage with people in their environments, that I had to work within my limitations. So I decided to really use these restrictions. And I rented a room in Berlin and I invited friends and a few people I didn't know at the time to come into this room where we created a project together.
Mm-hmm. How do you start with a project like that? I mean, it's very performative and intuitive, as you say, and you probably never know what exactly will come out of this.
Absolutely. But this is interesting to be talking to you about this because it's a little bit of I'm in MA mode, you're in MA mode. So I can talk about the MA-ness of the process. So one thing that I did for this project that I'd never done before was I really made a really extensive visual research portfolio. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did that was because there were months where I was stuck in The Hague where I couldn't photograph and I couldn't do things. And I still, like, you know, my creative soul is still in need of stimulation. And so I just started collecting images and looking at images and just thousands and thousands and thousands of images. And I then kind of pared it down into an object that really served me in terms of dividing up different kind of modes of inspiration. So I divided into sections, but the sections were like choreography, intuition, shape, form, body, face. And that was really helpful for me. But what was interesting is it became really helpful as soon as I invited people into the room, because mm-hmm. as most of the people I photographed are also creative people. And so words can do so much, but being able to show them kind of visual inspiration, and it wasn't about copying images or recreating things we'd seen before, but it was about saying, hey, here are some possibilities. What do you see here? What excites you? What do you not want to do? What does this inspire you? How does it inspire you? And it became this kind of little secret weapon that I could always return to. And it's interesting to look at it now, that the images are done, particularly because that research portfolio is very colorful and my project is black and white. But I can see where a lot of the images did kind of come from.
I know the project is a lot about boundaries as well. Some of the images are super intimate, some are more explorative, and I'm curious, how did it work out?
Yeah, it's interesting you say boundaries. I guess I think of the word restrictions. I kind of set this series of restrictions and we worked within those. Those restrictions included, okay, a physical space. We're making images in this space. But other than that, there weren't a lot of restrictions in that I invited people to really bring their own ideas and their own desires for how they wanted to be seen. There was a lot of talk of what they wanted out of the work and what I wanted out of the work and what maybe we could do together that they couldn't do with someone else and that I couldn't do with someone else. So it was kind of about setting restrictions to give the freedom to make things that probably otherwise wouldn't exist. Mm. And the thesis I wrote talks a lot about my role as a voyeur and really kind of an enabler and catalyst, and really someone who works a lot with people who would call themselves exhibitionists, performers, people who like to be seen, people who like an audience, people who like a stage. And this project was about finding the middle ground between that, where I became slightly of an exhibitionist and they became slightly more voyeuristic. It was very much mirroring back and forth. And in the thesis, I write a lot about how the constraints of BDSM are something I've applied to this project. The idea of consent and enthusiastic consent and ongoing consent and understanding what power and responsibility, top or a bottom or a sub or a dom or a photographer or someone being photographed, what those roles are.
And how do you see your role in this project?
I definitely am still a voyeur, but I'm a voyeur who likes to voyeur people who want to be seen. So I've never been a street photographer. I've always photographed people, but I've never photographed people who don't want to be photographed. Obviously, there's some situations where, you know, maybe there's someone I really wanted to make a portrait of and they weren't so into it, but I've never kind of anonymously photographed people or gone out on the street looking for images. I've always really consciously sat with someone and photographed someone who's very aware of my presence. And that's something I continue to do. And with this project, we took it to the next level. So I would say in this project, I'm an enabler, I'm a catalyst, I'm an ally, and I'm a bit of a, I think enabler is the right word, of like being able to provide medium and a space for people to really explore their desires and their wants and needs. And I think it's also important to know that this project was made during COVID. You know, a lot of public spaces disappeared, and a lot of the people I photographed are people who maybe were professional performers, or if not, were people who still, you know, love to get dressed up and go out dancing and be seen. And there was these moments that we weren't conscious of beforehand, but that came out in the room of like, wow, you know, people just saying it's amazing to be able to be seen again, to be able to perform, even if it's for a tiny audience, even if it's just for you, even if it's just for the camera, even if it's for the world, but just to be in my body and seen again.
I consider myself a portrait photographer when I came to Royal Academy of the Art, and I think I still do, but I had so many big questions about photographing people and being that person on the other side of the camera and what can it do potentially to the other person. Your project is very much about being seen, and you talk about this importance of being seen, but also about public space and how we got removed from public space. And I think for some people, it's a very political topic, right?
I think there's a lot to unpack in that question. I also came to this program as someone who photographs people, and I think we've both experienced a program that doesn't emphasize that, and in fact really forces you to question why, how, and if you're going to continue doing that. One of the things I've really seen, I think this comes from very important places and very important concerns, but I do see a tendency now for many people to just absolutely shy away from photographing people because they haven't in the past and they're not currently doing it in morally correct ways. I think it's great if those people who can't do that stop photographing people. However, I'm not going to stop photographing people, and I'm going to make mistakes and I'm going to keep making mistakes, but I'm going to do the best I fucking can. And I think there really is room to continue photographing people. And I think we have to address a lot of concerns about who we're photographing, particularly as people from quote unquote global north. I'm a white woman. I have a lot of privileges in my life. I can inadvertently wield a lot of power with a camera. And I'm aware of that. What I'm trying to do now is, instead of throwing out the practice of photographing people, I'm just trying to do it better, to continue to question myself, to continue to admit to my mistakes. And mostly for me, that means to engage with people who really want to be photographed. And the thing is that there's a lot of people in a lot of places who really want to be photographed. I understand a lot of the concerns. And also, look, we're talking about images here. They're not photojournalism. They're not news. They're not assignments. Also, they weren't made with any kind of financial exchange. The only reason to make images like this is because you want to, and because you need to. So I'm aware of the issues of photographing people. And again, I will say, of course, I know I've made mistakes in my past, but I continue to try to improve on that. And really, with this project, I built a set of ethical guidelines for myself and kind of a checklist to follow, which is a really good way to keep checking in and making sure I'm on the right path.
This project it's very much about being seen, and yeah. it's about being seen maybe not in a public space, because of course it doesn't take place in a public space, but being seen by the other and taking space.
Yeah, what came out of the project, and this was something that really happened once I began photographing, was this idea of we built a stage. We built an invisible stage in a room that didn't have curtains and lights and all of these things. It had flimsy, crappy, stained, white, falling apart curtains, and it had two windows, and there was the sun, and sometimes it was there, and sometimes it was hiding, and sometimes it was strong, and sometimes it was weak, and that was it. But it was nevertheless a stage. And most of the people I invited to take part in this project really wanted to be photographed. And a lot of people, it was at a point where, you know, for almost the better part of a year, people hadn't had the opportunity to be photographed. And it was at a time where things were changing in Berlin. So regular testing was coming in, and we could do it in a more or less safe way, which was also something that wouldn't have been possible a couple of months earlier. So there was a lot of considerations of that, of, you know, can we work with open windows? Can we get COVID tested regularly? This was pre-vaccines, and only seeing one person at a time, and trying to space out the shoot so that there was time between people, you know, trying to do this as safely as possible. But yes, it became very much, this is a stage, this is a place. And again, the idea of people who, even if they aren't necessarily professional performers, they're people who enjoy being seen, who enjoy being acknowledged. And this was a chance to really do that on their own terms. And there were some people I asked to take part who really are not so comfortable in front of a camera. And that presents its own challenges. But I think there's this idea of kind of ongoing and enthusiastic consent, which is really different than manipulation. There were some people who said no, they didn't want to take part, and that was fine and great. And some people who wanted to take part, but took a while for them to get comfortable in front of the camera. And that's where I see my role really comes out, as someone who can enable comfort and can work within their boundaries. There's a lot of nudity in this work, but nobody had to get naked. And it was something that we kind of worked through with each person. And one of the things I think is really interesting is, you know, the results of the images, I think to an outsider looking at them, is he wouldn't necessarily know who was dying to get naked and who definitely didn't want to. But then also when we talk about audience and stage and performance, another aspect of the work is that near the end, I started live streaming some of the photo shoots. That was a way to bring in an audience of sorts, but also to really play with this idea of voyeurism and exhibitionism. And living in a time where so much was mediated through a screen, it became this, you know, we all know how to Zoom now, we all know how to do this, and it became this really fun other layer. And for a lot of the people I photographed at that point, they loved it. They wanted more of an audience. The idea now, the project in its current form, is a series of zines that fold together and that unfold, where then the audience has the power to curate their own exhibition. So a lot of it is about these, you know, power dynamics and who has the power and giving and taking power.
The other night, my friend told me that she had a really difficult time recently and told me, oh, you know, I booked myself this intimate photo session, and she had it done, and she showed me the images. They were really good images, and it's interesting how it was important for her, and this another layer of publishing it. I find it really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are interested in exploring how they're seen and how they're represented. And obviously with social media now, people have control of their image in a way they've never had in the past. But that said, there's still, you know, technical limitations, and, oh, I couldn't get that angle and I wanted this or that. And that's where maybe someone else comes in. And some of these images as well, I was almost more of a technician, of they would really bring ideas and, you know, I would push the button. And that to me feels great. The things people came and showed up with were just incredible. Like, it was mostly ideas, the willingness to be vulnerable in this space. And I think, again, you know, this is kind of an extreme example of people who really like to be seen, but there's a piece of that in a lot of people. Your friend isn't the only person who's hired someone to make intimate photos of them. And there's a power in that. There's a power in, I'm deciding this, it's on my terms, I'm paying for it, and I get a product, and I want something that makes me feel good.
When you show other body types, it's such a taboo. But when you go through the street, you see it all over. Like, it's all over its naked bodies, usually feminine bodies. I think it's about introducing other kind of intimacies. And then a body also becomes a political object as well.
There's a certain kind of nudity that is almost invisible to us, particularly in white Western Europe and North America. And that's the nudity that exists on billboards and magazines and on most social media. We don't notice it anymore. What we notice is when something subverts the expectations. So as soon as a body is different, is bigger, is smaller, is darker, is scarred, is deformed, is seen in an unexpected way, or as soon as we see something that we're not used to seeing again and again and again and again, it grabs our attention in a different way. We see that this has obviously been used hugely in marketing and advertising, particularly in the past few years. And I also see how people are adapting to their ideas of new normalcies of what bodies are and what bodies can be. And this project maybe isn't as groundbreaking as it would have been 10 years ago, but it also couldn't have existed 10 years ago. What I see is this project an opportunity to really, the people I chose and asked and invited to be photographed were chosen less for their bodies and more for their minds. And it just so happens that they're a pretty fucking diverse group of people with a diverse group of bodies. And that said, you know, I was also really aware of that. I'm a fat woman. My body I don't see very often in the media. I'm terrified of my body in many ways. And with all these health issues in the past year, my body feels like my foe and not my ally. And so I wanted to really explore that. And I consciously tried to find people with experiences that were similar to mine. It wasn't always easy, but I do think that challenge was worth it.
Sounds like a fantastic lesson. Would you be willing to talk about your previous project that has also been published as a book, Rise, where you talk about many things? But actually yesterday I was watching this football match and I was thinking about this. I'm always a little bit skeptical about football, and I think like, oh my god, it's just this man chasing this ball, and it's again this idealization of male sportsmen, and it also has this nationalistic tendency sometimes. But then on the other hand, yesterday was this match and I was planning to read, but then it wasn't a TV, I put it on, and I think there's also something beautiful about it, how I get emotional, how my dad gets emotional in another country, and there's this emotional layer to it. I don't know exactly what to think about it, but what you did, you used football as a in a very interesting way in your project. So what about football that you found attractive?
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about there. A couple years ago, I made a project called Rise about a football team in Berlin. And for amateur women players, the team was called Champions Ohne Grenzen, which is Champions Without Borders. It's a team for refugee women. And that is one aspect of the work I've done about football. And I think to address your question directly right away, I don't give a fuck about football. But I love football. So I'm someone, I wasn't into sports growing up. I think that was partly because I was a dancer. You kind of had to choose. You couldn't be doing both. I didn't grow up in a house that watched sports. I never watched sports on TV. But in years of traveling, I found myself often going to sports events in other countries because it became a way to kind of connect with a cultural moment, you know, who's here, who's going, what are we looking at, and kind of, you know, meeting people and sharing an experience. You know, it's one of the few places, especially in male-dominated worlds, where people are allowed to have emotions, and, you know, there's so much passion, and there's community, and there's collectivity. And so, but I wasn't consciously aware of that. And quite a few years ago now, I, through a friend, heard about this organization called Discover Football in Berlin. And it's a volunteer-run organization that works with international women playing football. And I went to a small conference just to volunteer to make some pictures of, you know, hey, I can take pictures and give them to you. And I was absolutely awestruck in what the women there had to say. And that time, it was the 5th anniversary of Discover Football. And it was a group of 13 international women from really all over, from Russia, Australia, Lebanon, South Africa, Colombia, Palestine, some different places. And it was shocking to hear how similar each of their narratives was in terms of what they had to do to fight to be able to have the right to play football at all. And kind of from day one, I just got hooked. I found this so fascinating. And again, I think a lot of people don't see the connections between the work I do about football and the work I do about the body. But it, for me, it's very connected. It's all about agency. It's all about the body. It's all about the right and freedom to exist, freedom of movement, freedom to use your body how you want to use your body. So I started photographing amateur women football players around the world. What happened over the years was football became less and less the focus because, you know, I like football, but what I really like are the women who, in this context, I'll say women in the most inclusive form of women who play football. It became a way for me when traveling to automatically or very quickly connect with a group of feminists, activists, deviants, radicals, you know, people who were doing unexpected things. So football was, yeah, the red thread that maybe tied through many of the experiences. But for me, it was only kind of the excuse to engage with amazing women in who were often also community activists and organizers and people who were oftentimes in many different places just simply fighting for the right to play football. In the years since I started that work, women's football internationally has changed and it's evolved and it's amazing to see. And I still think I will never stop doing it because it's, again, just a way, you know, young women, old women, women with all different bodies, women. It's just been incredible to meet people from very, very different backgrounds, you know. And of course, we talk about diversity, but, you know, people from all different countries and religions and races and class and all of these issues, which really football becomes kind of the conduit to explore these issues and issues like access, education access, health access, integration. There's a lot of work about migration in all different countries, people coming from different places. And I've been super fortunate in that through football and through Discover Football, I've been able to connect with women in places I just never expected to go to and to find. And it's been an amazing experience.
It sounds fantastic. It's interesting how the moment when a woman or a girl starts playing football, it becomes a political thing and not really just a thing, right?
You know, it's interesting. I'm just thinking, you know, I've before this current project, Skin Berlin, I've done work in the past about pornography, particularly queer pornography and feminist pornography. I'll tell you what, I love that work, but I don't get grants with it. I don't get fellowships with it. I don't get access to spaces. And as soon as I started doing work about women's football, suddenly doors open. I'm getting funding. I'm getting access. I'm getting opportunities. And it's because, you know, it is, it's a feel-good topic. It's also, it's politically engaged. It's not dangerous in the same ways that naked bodies are. God forbid, pornography. So for me, it is very interesting. And I will admit, I've used that to my advantage for sure. You know, I'm very aware of that. Being able to make work that has a platform in order to enable me to make work that doesn't necessarily have a platform. So that's something I'm super aware of. You know, also like the NGOs and these organizations running these teams and stuff, it's brutal for them to get funding. But when they can have photographs or they can have images or they can have kind of this different platform, they're taken seriously on a different level and they can then access funds, which of course many politicians love to put their stamp on it and say, look what we did, we're doing the feel-good work. But that work is important and it does really affect lives. And Rise was a great example of that, of focusing on one team and becoming very close over the course of a few years with a small group of players and really watching them as they settled into new lives and built new lives and brought along their histories and in many cases traumas, and how they could incorporate that into new worlds. And football is an opportunity to be physically active, to be able to express emotions, to be angry, to be sad. You can cry on a football field. You can scream, you can jump, you can run, you can fall down. Like you can, it's place. And again, this is where I see so much of the connection with the other work I do. It's about agency. It's about rights. It's about saying I am here on my own terms.
Mm. You can be seen expressing your own emotions however much you want. I've never thought about that. That's really, now when I think about the matches, then it makes total sense.
And maybe just coming back to our dance background, when you're a dancer, you don't get to do that.
Yeah, it's like a perfect place of freedom.
You don't get to scream on stage. You don't, I mean, now you do, and you know, contemporary dance has changed dramatically, but so much of what I remember about being a dancer was being told what to do and exactly how to do it. Mm. And I think maybe I've been like fighting that ever since.
Interesting. I was doing a lot of freestyle at some point. I started in more of this technical structured thing, but then I naturally moved towards this more free place where you're free, but you still have a language that is pre-prescribed. I think for me, it was most importantly a place of freedom where you could not just express your emotions, but leave your emotions and be seen.
You know, that's a really good point. I'm being slightly critical, I guess, because of I had one very specific experience of what dance could be. Many of my contemporaries and colleagues and peers at that time have continued to be dancers and performers. And in fact, one of my dear friends who was a wonderful performer, who's now just finished her PhD in Canada, we were talking about my thesis and my work. And in my thesis, which takes a very personal tone, I wrote, when I'm photographing is kind of the only time when I'm truly free and I'm not worried about all the other things, and my body does things it doesn't do otherwise, and I'm so in the moment and I can see ahead and behind and in the shadows and the light. And she said, you know, this is what I always said about dance was, for her, it was the one time she really was truly herself and had that freedom. Mm. So I never had that experience with dance, which is why I think I left it at a pretty early age.
No, it's magic to find a place where you can feel truly yourself. Yeah, and you've been admitted to PhD in Toronto.
Something I definitely thought I would never, ever, ever do. COVID changed the world. It changed my life pretty drastically. I've been living in Berlin for many years, and I came to the Netherlands, you know, which feels close by. And it was really close until borders started closing and COVID regulations came in. And I did this master's, and one of the things that I really got out of the program was that I'm not necessarily interested in just being a photographer and just being a solo photographer and a name. I get a lot out of facilitating for others and teaching and trying to organize projects and groups and supporting individuals and supporting people on a group level, you know, in an institutional level and on a personal level. And what I came to appreciate from MAPS, particularly a few of our faculty, one of whom listeners will be familiar with, Shiloh Phillips, is that a practice can include many different aspects. And for me, I now see my artistic practice as something that I'm a photographer and I make pictures, but I also write and I also organize and I also teach and I moderate and I lecture and I different forms of communication. So I was looking at what the world had to offer at this point for me and continuing to work as a mainly commercial photographer and also someone who relied on grants. It doesn't feel like enough anymore. So I'm way more interested in organizing and taking part in things that aren't centered on me and my artistic practice. So I'm looking at the PhD as an opportunity to give me the skills and access to really be able to have a practice that includes facilitating for other people, teaching, building, community organization, activism. You know, there's a lot of things I don't have time for because I'm so busy making pictures. It's kind of bullshit, right? So I don't need to make pictures all the time. I get, you know, if I had the opportunities to be using that time in other ways, it's something I really want to do. So now I'm very passionate about not making photographs in some ways and really looking at what some of my other skills are and how I can apply those skills to support others.
Fantastic. How does it feel to go away from Berlin to the city where you come from?
I love Berlin. I feel a very, very strong attachment to Berlin. I am heartbroken to leave it. I'm not leaving because I want to. I'm leaving because I feel like the opportunity, I couldn't make opportunities happen there in a way that I think I'll be able to, sadly, in North America. So Berlin is in many ways, you know, I moved there when I was 29. I kind of grew up there in many ways, and I have wonderful community, and I have an incredible creative supportive network. I also, you know, I speak the language now, I got citizenship, I got a passport, I did all the things a good immigrant is supposed to do, and unfortunately I still feel like there are barriers there that I won't professional barriers that are very difficult for me to overcome. In some ways, I feel that there are still barriers in Berlin I'll never be able to overcome in terms of professional access. And in North America, that's a different story. Mm. So it's bittersweet. I also am, nothing is forever, but I know I'm making the right decision for me. And I think what I'm doing is being able to build a practice that I could then potentially bring back to Berlin.
Dear listener, I have enjoyed talking to Alexa so much that the last conversation felt like it was being cut short. There's so much more I wanted to ask her, and I wanted to continue the conversation. We both decided to meet one more time and continue for a bit longer. I hope you're going to enjoy it just as much as I did. So, how are you doing now?
So now I'm in Toronto, and you're in The Hague. And we're doing this 2021 style with some technology. So it might sound a bit different. But yeah, I think both of us were really happy with the conversation last time, but felt like there was stuff still left unsaid.
And I think I actually just really enjoyed that, but felt like it was cut short. So let's see. Let's see what can come up. You were before moving to Berlin and then moving to Toronto, and now you're actually in a final destination. So how does it feel?
It's been a very chaotic summer, but I was able to go to Berlin. And what was amazing was that while packing up my life, I was able to meet almost everyone from my project, Skin Berlin, and give them a copy of the publication, and they could finally see the work. That was an amazing experience. I think so often as photographers, we make these images, but everything that happens afterwards is so disconnected from maybe the people in the images. And so to finally bring the work directly to the participants and to show them what we made was this really incredible experience, and had some really nice moments, some really touching moments. Obviously, I photographed this project, but then to bring it into a final form, which I talked about last time, this folding publication that folds out into an exhibition. So I was able to give each person their own copy of this publication and to like invite them to start doing what they wanted with it, right? So some people have been sending me photos of what they put on their wall, or some people have been like cutting it up, or people have been doing different things. And it was a really nice moment of goodbye to Berlin and goodbye to my amazing creative collaborators. Not goodbye forever, but goodbye for now. But to be able to bring this thing in my hands of this offering of acknowledging this time we spent together. Mm. And now I'm in Toronto.
Great. There's a lot of talk about photographers being a solitary creatures. And I was just thinking, what's your take on it? What you're talking about is the opposite from that. The reason why I was thinking about this question is, I don't know how much can I mention your thesis, but there was already the first page where you, just the way you thank people, it already got me thinking. When you create work, it's always kind of solitary, but at the same time, it's not. What do you think about that?
I think it's really interesting you ask me that right now. I am someone who is very comfortable on my own, and I spend a lot of time on my own. And I really like my time to myself. And I've been living on my own for, 15 years. For the past 2 weeks, I've been living in a familial situation where I suddenly am having to consider other people's time and schedules and desires. And it's a whole new way of living, and I'm having to learn to be a lot less selfish in my day-to-day routine. But in terms of photography, you know, I'm someone who I need time by myself, but my creative process always involves other people. And I'm someone who I don't particularly enjoy photographing things that aren't people. I know there's a lot of artists who really, really enjoy working on still lifes or creating things in a studio or working in nature or working without people. And for me, I do that sometimes, but the enjoyment for me really comes from the human interaction.
So as much as I need my alone time, I think that's in part because when I'm with people, my time with them is generally very intense. And especially when I'm photographing or interviewing or meeting people, when I'm doing that, I give all of my energy. And when that's over, I need to recuperate. I've often been called a lone wolf, and it's something I think about, especially as I talk about making collaborative work. But I think something that's important for me, at least, is making the time and having the time to reflect on what we do rather than just creating, creating, creating. And that's a pattern I'd been in for years, actually, until the masters. The masters really slowed me down. So one of the things I really got out of the program and my time working on this project was having some distance and being able to really reflect on it. And, you know, being in this master's program, you have to write a thesis. And my thesis became directly informed by the project I made. And it was a chance for me to really reflect on our time together in that room, but also to hold myself accountable to the entire process and where the project started, what happened, and where it ended, and to challenge myself. I'll say again and again, I make mistakes, you know, to challenge myself to acknowledge those mistakes and move forward from them. And to also really take the time to appreciate how giving the participants were, how intense our time together was. It wasn't just a photo shoot. It was therapy and emotional and wonderful and cathartic. And I do think it's important to be able to take the time to acknowledge that.
I have this one quote that I think it describes really well what you were talking about, and I was really moved by it. It says, "I've always expected way more of myself than of anyone else. And it's that respect that has led me to an archive of images that are unexpectedly intimate and personal, no matter where in the world I make pictures." I can see that. It made things really clear to me. I feel like I understand it much better now. But there's another one that I would like to ask you about. And it says, "I dare not employ the same techniques on others that I would employ on myself. When photographing others, I am constantly consciously or unconsciously trying to make photographs that they will find attractive, seductive, and beautiful. And I recognize this so much."
This is something I've thought about a lot. One of the things I take great pleasure and pride in is the feedback I get when I photograph people of they tell me how maybe fulfilling or how great the actual experience was of making the images. I struggle with that sometimes because I know that often that doesn't always make the greatest photographs necessarily. I think historically I've looked at a lot of artists' work and thought, I want to do that. I want to be more like that. But when I go into it further and look at their techniques or maybe have witnessed their techniques, I know I could never do that. So this project, Skin Berlin, was actually the perfect example of just being so extremely honest with my desires and my hopes, and to say to each person, this is what I want to do. Where are your comfort levels? Because again, it's not about manipulation, but it was like, I want to make photos that I haven't made before. I want to make photos that are uncomfortable. I want to make photos that challenge expectations. And rather than trying to quote unquote steal those images, instead, I was like, let me find some people who really want to go there with me. And that was what was amazing about this project is that a lot of the people, particularly the people I've known for years, they also saw it as an opportunity to like, let's make ugly photos, Alexa. Let's do these things. Like, let's go to uncomfortable places. We've made so many beautiful photos, and these photos are beautiful, I will say, but we were able to kind of move beyond that. One thing I've always struggled with is having people be happy with the images I make of them. I think my baggage always comes along with that. So I'm always aware, and there's certain things, and I think, well, they're not going to like that, or they're not, you know, and I don't want to show them something maybe that makes them uncomfortable or that triggers them in a negative way. So I ended up really censoring what I show to people. And I, in hindsight, realized that wasn't the way to do it. You know, the way to do it is to involve them from the start and be super clear about the intentions. And like I said before, to have these visual references so people know what I'm doing. So it's not an opaque process. And that's what I think this time, Skin Berlin, was the first opportunity or first time I really took advantage of that and made it a core part of the creative process.
I really recognize what you're saying. I am a massive people pleaser and I can read people's, I don't even think I read it. Sometimes I think I just impose these ideas of what they might want or what they might like, what they might not like. I don't know. My rational mind thinks you can't rationally know what the other human being will like if they haven't even seen it. But I feel like I do this censoring a lot in my images. And this is this unconscious process that goes every time when you work with somebody. It's interesting.
You know what? It's really nice to hear you say that because I don't think I've necessarily thought of it in that way, but I really identify with that. I think especially because I've made images around the world and worked with people who I don't know for years and I maybe don't know intimately. It's something I've really struggled with, of like imposing my own expectations of what they want. Mm. Rather than letting people explore and experiment. You know, as we've talked about before, people are more in power and control of their image than ever before with social media. People can present their personas, their bodies, their faces in the ways they want to. So if they're going to be working with someone else like us as photographers, there's got to be a reason for that. We're not there to duplicate what they can do on their own. We're there to create something that can only be created with the two of us.
And I think there's always this element of negotiation, right? Like how much in this image, how much is there me and how much is there you? And I think, of course, you can just make a pretty smiley picture, which will be picture created for them. I think it's always about finding this point, no? Like, I don't think there's one remedy for that.
You know, that reminds me, because I, for many years early on in my career, I worked as a photo assistant for some top fashion and portrait photographers. Mm. And generally the way those kinds of commercial jobs work is that you go to a location or a studio ahead of time and you set everything up and you have someone who stands in or sits in to represent the celebrity or whoever it is so you'll be photographing. And what you've done is you've created an entire scenario that then this person walks into, takes part in for maybe only a few minutes, slides into the situation. And sometimes it's only for a few minutes, sometimes it's longer. But in general, you're not collaborating in that moment. You've preconceived of this idea, you've set everything up, and you're sliding this person in. Whereas when I work, I don't come in with those preconceived ideas of what the final image is going to look like. And for me, it's about really reacting to what we're creating together. So that involves, you know, I'm reacting to the location, the light, the shadows, the, you know, all these things that as a photographer we just see immediately. And then I'm reacting also to the person in front of me and their comfort levels and how their body moves, how their face moves, whatever it is. And so for me, I get so much more out of creating something spontaneously rather than coming in with these preconceived ideas and sliding, to use the word negatively, sliding a model in to a situation.
I think that's just like a beautiful lesson to approach life with. See people with curiosity rather than with these ideas. You've been observing the bodies for this long period of time and you were thinking about that, and that definitely gives you some different perspective. And this is kind of a question I just egoistically ask for myself. How much can a body convey somebody's state or trauma or experiences or something bigger? And that, of course, goes to how much can we visually portray these things?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you said, you know, we can't photograph someone's soul or state of mind, you know, immediately I'm like, well, wait, can we? But can't we in some ways? Or maybe photography is not the right word. But we can visualize, you know, and I think that's so much of what art has been forever and ever and ever, right? Is trying to find ways to convey states, whether that's, you know, states of turmoil or enjoyment or ecstasy, isn't that the root of it, what music is, what painting is, what sculpture is? I think that's a great question, and I think it's really the root of a lot of the work I do. There's two separate questions here, right? Is can we visualize things that are invisible, things like trauma, which is a different question than can the body represent these states? I think absolutely the body almost can't hide our experiences. We can pretend and we can try, but ultimately these things come out. We carry our entire life experience in our bodies. People who are very tuned into their bodies can really use them in a productive way to really work through a lot of things. And I think most of us, especially in Western societies, are not that in tune with our bodies. So we maybe not consciously, using our bodies as tools for our experiences. You'll never be able to erase your past, and it will always manifest itself in some way. And I think this does go back to the beginning, the gestation of my project, which, as I said, was based on my own physical limitations. And my body gave out. And for the first time in my life, I was physically disabled. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that happened at a very stressful time in my life, but after years of experiences that I wasn't necessarily acknowledging. You can hide all you want, but it's going to catch up to you eventually.
I like that. Yeah, it's really smart. I'm going through that a lot now. I've been on a therapy for the first time in my life, and I can see all these things happening, which is really interesting. But ultimately really beautiful and really, really great to finally have a clear and transparent idea of who you are. My Instagram right now is just like following hundreds of different therapy advices, which is great. I actually think people who criticize Instagram, you can really make it into a very positive tool. I'm curious, in your opinion, how mature do you think we are in the perception of mental illness?
Oh, that's a hard one. You know, I'm not a psychotherapist. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a neurologist. I'm not a scientist. But I do have a lot of experience of living through mental illness and also being exposed to mental illness from a very young age in a way that I think has actually served me very well in life in terms of how I am able to interact with people with all different experiences. I think we say we're okay with mental illness, but I don't know if we really are. When we talk about my thesis, I write a lot about my own issues with depression and obsessive tendencies and these kinds of things. But I already like feel myself censoring, thinking, oh, well, this might go out to a public audience. I'm maybe trying to get hired for this job, or I want to be considered for this. And being vulnerable or honest about these things can be really tricky. I will say the project I did and the last year of my master's and my thesis was a lot about accepting and embracing vulnerability. And I'm getting better at it. It still goes against my instincts. I'll still never be able to use social media properly. But I do really see how effective a tool it can be to connect with others. And when we talk about representation matters, which is often used to talk about, you know, seeing people of different ethnicities, for instance, represented in media, I think representation matters also in these things. And being able to maybe see someone who has been through struggles with mental illness, who is still creating, who's still quote unquote successful in some ways.
I have this one quote that I think it describes really well what you were talking about. It's a quote from, I believe, Maya Angelou. So the quote goes, "Bitterness is like cancer. It eats upon the host. It doesn't do anything to the object of its displeasure. So use that anger. Yes, you write it, you paint it, you dance it, you march it, you vote it, you do everything about it. You talk it. Never stop talking it." I just think it's so brilliant.
Yeah, and it's this idea that, you know, holding on to resentments is basically poison. And we have every right to be angry and to be hurt and to feel, but someone like Maya Angelou was able to channel that energy, you know? And I think that is something I aspire to and something I try to do. And it's not easy on a day-to-day basis, but she's definitely someone I would look up to in that regard. Mm.
Nothing motivates you like a massive kick in your ass, but of course it can break you as well. So then it's quite bittersweet. So you talk a lot about buddies, and this work is a lot about buddies. And I was thinking recently how we do many things with our buddies in order to hide.
Well, if I understand you correctly, my response is to not a question, but just to what you're saying is that what I'm trying to do in this work and what I think a lot of people are doing now in their lives and also in the way they represent themselves is to move beyond the surface and is to move beyond the beautiful. Well, there's a couple things going on. Oftentimes people will do physical things to their body as a manifestation of what's going on inside, right? So, you know, you have example of dyeing your hair. I have examples of cutting my hair but you know, there's other manifestations of that, of body modification, some of which is very positive, some of which can be very problematic behaviors. You know, there's fine lines between destructive behaviors and empowering behaviors. And again, I'm going to say I'm not a psychologist or a psychotherapist, but I do see with a lot of the people I work with, particularly on this project, Skin Berlin, is an ownership of their representation and wanting to move beyond the don't take me at face value, don't assume all these things, don't assume my gender even, don't put all of your stuff onto me. And that's where I think this project was quite successful, of taking that ownership and that representation and turning people's expectations upside down. But isn't that also why we're creative people? Because we know we're trying to communicate things that maybe can't be said with words or we can't go through it in a normal day-to-day job. And so we found these other outlets, and photography is one of them. But I think you also have other outlets, and that's part of like our entire creative beings, you know?
I am, I'm a bit of a psycho fan of Rebecca Solnit, and you use her quote. I think it's just a very nice way to end it. I will just read the quote if you wanted to tell me what does it mean for you.
Yeah.
Hope is the belief that what we do matters, even though how and when it might matter, who and what it might impact, are not the things that we can know beforehand. We might not, in fact, know them afterward either, but they matter all the same.
Yeah, she's good, huh? You know, I have to say something about that quote, and actually what drew me to it was the word hope. And when I was in my last year of my undergrad in New York many years ago, we had this mentor show. So it was an exhibition of sorts. And we'd had this one amazing teacher who happened to be friends with this man named Hilton Ahls. And I don't know if you know who Hilton Ahls is, but he's a brilliant writer. I know him from his writing about mainly music and pop culture at the New Yorker, but he's done a lot since. I believe he's published one or two books since then. But Hilton Ahls came to this exhibition, and I had work that was nothing special, but I made portraits of my classmates. And he looked at the work and he said to me, with a tear in his eye, and he said, I see hope. I see hope here. And I have never forgotten that. I've never met him since. It was an absolutely magical moment of this person who is such a powerful, brilliant writer, but who could look at photographs and feel them on an instinctual and emotional level. I'm at the point in my life where I don't ever want to forget about the emotion and passion and connection that we can find through art and photography.
That is such a lovely way to phrase it. Thank you so much, Alexa. I absolutely loved talking to you. And
there's hope for both of us.
I think it was brilliant.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The team of Photography and Society, the podcast, would like to thank Ben Smith, our supervisor, Echo the Dolphin and Julia Koch, who designed all the music parts, and the Department of Photography and Society of the Royal Academy of Art in The Hague. If you want to know more about the topic of this episode, please visit the platform where you found us for more info. Photography. Society.